If you're a long form player and you're looking to get some new tools to help you create entertaining and hilarious long form shows, well, that's what the Artist Low Comedy Advanced Ensemble class is all about. We'll teach you how to use the suggestion that you get from the audience that works for you, the importance of bringing different energies and different styles into a long form show so it holds together as an entire piece, and how you can do walk-ons that don't hijack the scene but support your fellow players. I'm really excited because I'll be offering the Artist Low Comedy Level 3 Advanced Ensemble in two sessions this May. The first one will be on Wednesday, May 26th. That's when it starts, and it will be offered from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Standard Time. The second one will be starting Friday, May 28th, in the morning from 10 a.m. to 12 noon. I limit this to 10 people max. Now, if you've never worked with me before, you're going to have to get my approval. So if you've got some experience, all you have to do is email me, and all that information will be at my website, which is jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. Now, if you sign up before May 12th, the class is only $259. After that, the price goes up to $289. So get in on the early bird discount now. Go to my website, jimmycorain.com, for more information and to register. That's jimmycorain.com.
Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Oh,
Hey, everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, and I'm the host of Improv Nerd, and we have another great episode for you today. Our guest today is Nancy Hayden. She is a writer, producer, actor, director, teacher, and the artistic director of the Second City Training Center in Chicago. She started improvising at the Second City Detroit back in the 90s, and she ended up appearing in 5 revues. Recently, she moved from Los Angeles to Chicago to take the job of the artistic director at the training center. We talked to Nancy about how she creates characters when she improvises and how she teaches a special exercise that gives the improviser an adjective or an emotion to put in their head before they improvise. She tells us about how she learned on the job, because when she was hired at the Second City to do the main stage show, she had no or very little improv experience. And we talked to her about how she feels that improv can make a difference in people's lives. Before we get to that episode, I just want to say, it's good to be back. And since I last did an episode, Lauren and I have moved into a house. We lived in a townhouse for a while. Now we've moved into a house, and I'm slowly, it might surprise you, but I'm slowly enjoying it. The first month, I walked around finding everything that was wrong with the house and convincing myself that I had made a big mistake. That has changed a little. But as you can imagine, I'm still having a hard time making the adjustment. Joy is not something that comes easy to me. Enough about me. Let's get right to this episode, the Nancy Hayden episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Nancy Hayden, thank you for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Thank you for having me, Jimmy. I am thrilled to be here. Well, or should I call you James? Your name
says
James.
No, that's just for Zoom. The people that are listening, they don't know that. Well, they do know we're on Zoom. We're recording this on Zoom, Nancy.
Sure, so that's right.
Thank you for pointing that out to me. If I wasn't so nervous and I was better technically, I would change my name. But I'm going to get right down to the interview.
Absolutely.
I'm very serious, as you know.
Absolutely.
So originally you're from Detroit, and you graduated from the American Academy of Dramatic Arts in Los Angeles back in the 90s. Is that right?
Yeah, that's okay. Right.
And that's a very prestigious school. You're focusing on musical theater. You want to go to Broadway, and then your mom calls you and changes those plans.
Moms, right? I was living in Chicago. There was a little bit of a stopgap between LA and New York. I knew I didn't want to do TV, especially at the time. I was like, I'm a character actress. I'm in my 20s. I'd been playing 40-year-old women since I was 8. So I was like, no one's going to cast me at that age on television or in film now. So let me go do some theater for a while, which truly was my first passion. So I moved to Chicago for a while, but had nothing to do with improv or sketch. Ironically, I just did some theater stuff. And then, yeah, my mom was, my folks lived in Michigan, and my mom worked at the Flint Institute of Arts. And my roommate in Chicago moved out of my place. And she said, our lease was up. And she said, why don't you come home for, you know, 6 months or so and just kind of reboot and save some money and then go back to Chicago. And I thought, well, that's a good plan. And then the Second City, meanwhile, had been opening in Detroit while I hadn't been there yet. And they opened with the original Detroit cast, which included two Chicago cast members, Todd Stashwick and Susie Nakamura, who each had, I believe, like 4 or 6 month contracts to do like the first show, the first review, and kind of, you know, help get the brand new Detroit cast sort of off the ground. And so when those two left, they held another round of auditions to just replace those two people to kind of fill out the remainder of the original Detroit, you know, Second City cast of all Detroiters. And so I auditioned in that round and got the job. I got cast on the main stage.
Now, had you seen Second City up until this point?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd seen it. I saw, you know how everybody has one of those stories of like, I think I saw so-and-so. I saw the Turco perform at a college in Flint. And I think I could be romanticizing this at this point. I could be making it up in my you know, foggy memory, but I'm pretty sure that Stephen Colbert was in that cast. I remember like the tall, funny, dark-haired guy. I assume he toured. If he never toured, but I was a kid, like not a kid, but I was, you know, still in school, like high school or something, and saw it. And I was, you know, it was totally one of those, that's what I want to do moments. But you don't, it's funny that I hadn't really put it all together, because like Gilda Radner was a huge hero of mine from Detroit, as I was, you know, and I loved her. I loved Saturday Night Live. I loved everything about everybody comedy. I can't believe I hadn't put together yet that Second City itself should be a goal of mine. But I think, again, I think I was still too drawn to just sort of the traditional theater. I never did improv in high school. I never really did improv in college. So it took until the Second City came to town. Second City came and got me in my own hometown.
Well, and but what's interesting too is you, just like you said, you had no improv training or whatever.
Right.
Now you're thrown up on the main stage.
Yeah.
How do you learn improv besides doing it? I mean, do you pull people aside and say, hey, you know, what's this agreement thing?
Yeah. What's this agreement thing? I think I got that part because frankly, I think if I hadn't had a little, you know, I don't want to say innate ability, but I did okay, or I wouldn't have gotten the job. I mean, the audition itself was 5 solid days of auditioning. And we did everything from perform archive scenes to tons of improv. I remember we played a game of party quirks where I had a dog on my face. And I came in, and when the host said, complimented me or said anything nice to me, I would shake my head back and forth like the dog's tail was wagging. And I remember later one of the producers said, she was like, that was my moment with you. Like, that was the moment that was kind of when you cemented yourself in my mind to get the job. So truly it was, I think I auditioned on a Monday, and it was, there were, you know, so many people, and then they called back, you know, there were thousands of people, and they called back like 500, and then they called back like 50. And then by the time they got down to the final 7 of us, we literally went through like a 10-hour day on that final day of just tons and tons of stuff. So I think I knew the fundamentals a little bit. I had done a little bit in college. I think I mentioned to you one time when we were playing a show or something that I had done a troupe in college, but we never performed a show. We would get together and just rehearse. And my brother was an actor and an improviser, and he was 6 years older than me. So he was a huge influence on me. And he was the one who kind of started that troupe at Western Michigan, which was the college I went to for a couple of years before the academy. And so I had played around. I think I knew the rules a little bit, but yeah, I definitely pulled people aside from the cast. We were also super fortunate. So Detroit was like the first Second City franchise, if you will, if you want to call it that. There was just Chicago and Toronto. We were the first sort of experiment to do outside of those two, you know, institutions that were Second City for decades. For, you know, Toronto had been around for two decades by the time they finally decided to partner with anybody else and open one someplace else. So the Chicago group was really giving of their time. Like Sheldon Patinkin would come to town, watch our shows, give us notes, do workshops with us. Avery Schreiber came to town and did a workshop with us, played the set with us. Dave Pasquese came and did a Herald workshop with us and taught us how to do the Herald. Like it was, we were all kind of starting off together. You know, I mean, the rest of the cast had been around for, like I said, 4 to 6 months, but a lot of that stuff we were learning together. But yeah, the first time I played a Herald, it was probably after the Pasquese workshop. I came at everything so backwards because I learned the show first as an actor. You know, I got cast on, in typical Second City fashion, they cast me on a Friday and I went in on like Monday. I had 2 days to learn the entire main stage show. My put in rehearsal was like Sunday afternoon. So I had 1 day to go home and learn all of Susie's stuff. So that was my first job, was as an actor. And then the improv stuff, especially forms like the Herald, you know, you do that more as performance, the Herald. You don't do it as much for material generation, right? So that stuff I kind of learned later on. But the first time I ever played a Herald on stage in front of the Second City audience, this is going to absolutely destroy any cred that I have in the improv community. I wrote the form on my hand because I was so nervous. I wrote three scenes, game, one big scene. Like a dork. And yeah, so that was, but yeah, I mean, my cast was insanely talented, such gifted people. And I learned so much from them. And yeah, I just kind of, you know, I'd say my biggest improv coach was a live audience of, you know, 350 people for 7 shows a week. They'll teach you whether you're doing it right or not.
Is there a Detroit style of improv that's different than Chicago and Los Angeles and New York?
That's a really interesting question. I think that at least when I was coming up, I think that we played a little more slowly, if you will, because I think that everything was less pressure in Detroit. We didn't have, for good and for bad, you know, there was no producers from Saturday Night Live coming to watch us. There was no competition. So that's why we're so tight, because we were able to be so supportive. And there was also a little bit of kind of not the unwanted stepchild, but certainly the like stepchild thing of like, there was a lot, totally understandable. There were a lot of people who were like, oh, whatever the schlock is they're doing over there. Like, I guess we're McDonald's now. We're just going to open Second Cities everywhere. But, you know, we thought we were doing really good work at the time. Looking back on it now, having worked a lot more in this industry, I think we were doing really good work at the time. I was certainly working with some of my favorite people ever to perform with, who are hilarious. So yeah, I think we were able to kind of take our time and really, you know, begin scenes slowly, lay a strong foundation, develop character choices together, you know, in a slow, more methodical manner. In Chicago at that time, the long form sketch show had kind of taken over the world and was king, because Pinata Full of Bees and Paradigm Lost were happening. I mean, two of the greatest shows in the history of Second City, and they were very character-driven and incredibly, you know, of course, amazing performances, but they were also really fast and slick. At the same time that they developed, you know, Tom and Mick and guys like that were starting to direct these shows that had incredible character work. They also were developing, you know, more callbacks. They would take a scene that was a little too long and break it in half and put, you know, the first half of the first act and the second half in the second act. And transitions were starting to kind of like, it wasn't lights up, lights down so much. It was more seamless transitions. And all of that started to lend itself to, I think, faster play. I think that was the stuff that began, you know, if it trickles down from those types of shows, I think that was also when troops all around the country started doing like cut to stuff more often and tag outs and scenes and, you know, all of that stuff that sort of breaks up kind of a slow, more methodical scene. And yeah.
And Detroit also had more diversity in its cast before
we
Chicago.
Did. Yeah, we did. Yeah, that was kind of, I don't want to say what we were known for, but it was, I mean, first of all, I think that, you know, in order to do satire, obviously, your cast needs to reflect your community. Your cast needs to reflect your world. And certainly to do it in Detroit, at that time, especially, we needed to be able to talk to everybody, the people who lived in the city, the people who lived in the suburbs. A lot of our audience were like white suburbanites who came downtown to see our show. And we weren't letting them leave until we told them a thing or two about white flight and some other stuff. And so, yeah, we had three in that first cast I was in. We had three insanely talented BIPOC actors. Jerry Minor was in that cast, Angela Shelton and Chris Smith were the three people in that cast. And they, I mean, it was amazing because they were able to do, you know, scenes with layers and levels to them about the Black life experience where they didn't just play the same one person. It was like, oh, really? There are Black people who have different experiences and people of color who have different experiences in life and in the world and come from different socioeconomic backgrounds. How shocking. So they were able to put more than one, you know, BIPOC or person of color opinion on stage at the same time, like a scene with, you know, three Black people only talking to each other. And so that was, it was revolutionary for the time, I believe. And that began, those folks began to make their mark for Detroit Second City on Chicago as well, and kind of change our reputation a little bit and earn our reputation a little bit. Jerry was the first person who left the Detroit cast and went to the Chicago cast and worked at the ETC for a couple of years with, I mean, just those were like all-time casts. Neil Flynn, you know, Brian Stack, Jim Zulovic, like they were the four guys at one point, like just home run city, you know, Miriam Tolan, D. Ryan, like it, they were outrageously talented. I used to go and just sit in the back of the room and watch them play sets.
But
and,
you're one yeah. of those people too that believe that improv can change lives.
100%. Because again, because I've seen it happen. And I also, I mean, it's given me my performing life. It's giving me beautiful friendships. But I'm really excited by and passionate about the humanities side of improv. You know, like what Viola Smolin set out to do with these exercises all those years ago before it even became about, you know, yuck yucks and make 'em ups. Like it also changes people's lives. It gives them self-confidence. It gives them self-esteem. It changes children. It, you know, if you don't want to be a performer, fine, but there are still a million great reasons to take an improv class. Even more so if you don't want to be a performer. I tell a story all the time about a student that I had back in Detroit who's an attorney, and she was really made very nervous by improv, and she lit up and sailed through levels A and B. Well, levels A and B didn't have a class. Then we get to level C and there's a class show. They didn't have a show is what I meant. A and B didn't have a show. We get to C and there's a show. And I was her C teacher, and I noticed a real change in her during the weeks of the class as we got further and further along. And then she finally came to me and she was like, well, this has been fun, but I'm going to quit. And I was like, what do you mean you're quitting? You love doing improv. No, I just, it's been fun, but I'm going to quit. You know, well, come to find out, she's terrified of this class show. And I said to her, I'm going to put you in one game. You can pick the game, and I'll put you in the game and I'll call the game. And I'm telling you right now, if you go up, I will enter the scene and completely save you. You cannot fail. Just do this one show. And she did the class show. And then we're all backstage afterwards. And of course she crushed it. And we're all backstage afterwards. And she's just lit up again. And you know, like you've been on a roller coaster or you've been skydiving, like you're so terrified. And then it's like, when can I do it again? You know? And then she took D and then she took E. She went through everything. She still improvises to this day. And I taught her in like 2006 or something. And she's still an improviser. Like and she took the class because she was an attorney and she wanted to build like her public speaking skills because she probably wanted to do better in the courtroom or whatever. But those are the people for whom, you know, when you're bit by the bug and you want to be a performer, that part's easy. But when you learn a skill like this so that you can, you know, nail a job interview or talk to an intimidating gentleman in a podcast situation, or, you know,
I'm intimidating.
No.
Okay.
I mean, I just kind of wanted to float that out there for the listeners. You know, then it's, that's when I get all, no pun intended, nerdy about it, because I could talk forever about what it does for people off the stage.
What do you stress in your classes for improvisers?
Definitely the fundamentals, which obviously, you know, agreement and listening, but then starting from the who, you know, the who, the what, the where, because if there's one thing that drives me absolutely crazy, it's when people go, oh, now I've learned to improvise. Now I want to learn how to act. And it drives me bonkers, because my definition of improvisation is acting without a script. And whether you know, I've done both. When I've learned my part for a play and I've studied the character and done all the research that I need to do, the only difference in the performance is whether you're working with a script or without a script. But to my mind, great improv requires just as much character commitment as performing a play. So it drives me nuts when people talk about acting like it's a separate thing from improv. So I think that's all about the who. Like, if you don't learn those fundamental character choices, but it's the number one thing students come to me about later. And I don't think when I started teaching, I realized it, but after years of teaching and teaching all the different levels, when students come to me in the higher conservatory levels and they're getting closer to the process that where they're going to write and perform a show, their number one question is, every time I step out, I play myself. I can't stop playing myself. How do I stop playing myself? And, you know, and it's like, that's about acting skills. That's about making emotional choices. You know, playing a different character isn't about silly voices and mustaches and hats and, you know, and walks, although that stuff could be hilarious too. But, you know, making a different emotional choice can transform you into a different person. So
do you have an exercise that you do in class?
Yeah, I do.
Can you share that with us?
Yeah, absolutely. I do this a lot when I coach, especially. I coached a 2-person team and a 4-person team in LA for a very long time. And this was kind of our scenic warm up was I'll just like back line off the back line, you know, almost rapid fire scenes. It doesn't matter what the scenes are. They can be a minute long if you want, but right before you step out, you pick a word silently in your own head, and the word should be an emotion, a straight up emotion, or an adjective. I think the adjectives are really interesting because everybody knows, oh, I'm going to step out and play mad, you know, but when you boil it down to an adjective and you say, you know, you don't necessarily think of shy as an emotion, right? Or you don't necessarily think of, you know, conceited or, you know, pompous, or I guess those are the same thing, aren't they? Note to self, look up more adjectives. But you don't necessarily think of those adjectives as emotions, but just putting that word in your head, put the word insecure in your head before you step into a scene, and then filter every choice and everything you hear your scene partner say through that word first, and let it affect everything you do and say. And it builds a character for you. And you don't have to start from the outside in. You don't have to start from, you know, I'm terrible at dialects. I'm like known for it. Everything I do eventually kind of becomes sort of Irish. And then I don't even do Irish well, which is funny because I am Irish. So maybe that's why, because I don't do dialects well, I steered away from the external creation of characters. And it was like, it's going to have to be created from the inside out. So yeah, that's
so your characters all come from either an emotion you have, or what you were saying, like take a trait, shyness, yep, insecurity, conceited.
Because the dialect is like a prop. The dialect is nothing more than a mustache or a hat. You can't play a dialect. The dialect doesn't inform you who this person is. An emotion is the only thing you can play. When you go to acting school, obviously, what are you learning to do? You're learning to convey emotion on stage. So all day, as we interact with each other as people, that's all we're doing is conveying emotion. And, you know, you always hear people say that it's more interesting to watch someone on screen fight against crying than crying. You know, that one tear that Meryl Streep is able to make slowly drip down her face. Right. that's the same thing. That's interesting to me with emotion too. Like, I'll never forget this character that TJ Jagodowski played in Holy War Batman. You might remember the character, and he was the pottery teacher who was teaching a pottery class on 9/11 when 9/11 happened, and everybody was understandably aghast and mortified and upset and devastated, and they wanted to leave, but it was the day they were supposed to throw their pots, and so he didn't want to let anybody leave until they had finished their pottery work. And the tell for this character was whenever anybody would call it pottery, he would chuckle to himself, and then he'd go, well, it's the clay arts. And it was like this, it's the clay arts was this line that embodied everything about how you know, beta this character felt in the world, that he wasn't the alpha male, that everybody belittled his entire life's work by calling it pottery. And I mean, you know, anybody who knows that guy knows that he's the king of characterizations. And I will never forget that that character was a masterclass in making a choice, but not necessarily having a tell.
What did you learn by watching TJ?
That he becomes every person he plays, and from the inside out, you know, because that wouldn't ring true, that chuckle, you know, if he externally decided, oh, I'm going to chuckle and say the clay arts whenever anybody says this to me. I have no doubt, knowing TJ, that that probably came from improvisation, and it came from the fact that this guy seethed with anger whenever anybody said the word pottery. But think about real life. We don't explode when someone says pottery. We have to keep it together, right? So it's the same thing as Meryl Streep with the one tear. Instead of exploding and yelling at everybody, he laughs, he chuckles and says, well, it's actually the clay arts, but okay. You know, and then that goes on and on and on until finally he does explode. But I mean, that's the tell of that character, is like, that guy doesn't have it together. He absolutely does not have it together. And that is, it's real. Anybody who ever watches him says that about him. Like, he puts real people on stage in a way unlike maybe anybody else that I've ever seen play, except for maybe Tim Robinson. They're probably the two that bring the most realism to their characterizations, I think, that I've ever seen.
Getting to work with TJ, and I did for a period of time.
Did you really?
Yes. And the thing, I always tried to break him down. I always tried, like, after the show, TJ, you know, I would ask him questions. You know, I'm sure he's just the nicest person. But, you know, I
think really annoyed,
asking too many questions. But the thing that I always found amazing with this guy was, when we would do Harold's, and we get a suggestion, he would take that suggestion. And immediately, and you could see it in his eyes, he had a point of view. Just like you were mentioning that the pottery teacher, he would have a point of view and would just own it and make discoveries and discoveries and discoveries. It was beautiful to watch on one level, and frustrating. Like, oh my God,
How
does he do it?
I know. Well, that's how is you, because coming from that place, that point of view, it frees you up. Because you're not looking, you're certainly not looking for the joke, which we should never be looking for. And you're not even looking for the next thing to say. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm this person who feels this way about the world. And maybe I'm trying to hide it, or maybe I'm trying to telegraph it. Maybe I'm trying whatever. But then it frees me up to pay my attention to you, my scene partner, and to listen to everything you say. Because he's also, is he not, one of the most present improvisers.
Yeah. And, you know, getting back to the exercise that you talked about, what do you think, you know, and this is just hypothetical theory. We're in the lab.
Sure.
What do you think TJ, based on your exercise of like taking a word, what do you think he would have walked out on stage with? What do you think his word would have been?
Oh, wow. For that specific character?
Yes.
Probably, I don't even know how to boil it down to one word, but probably, like I said, like beta, like cuck, you know what I mean? Like a guy who never, he probably wanted to be a famous artist, you know? And so it's that thing. Now, granted, again, by the time you see him play this character in Holy War, it's been polished for the show, but in the first improv outing, probably something like Insecure or, you know, or somebody who never quite made it, you know, an artist who never quite made it. So they're teaching instead, right? Because if this guy's teaching pottery, he's probably a frustrated artist. Like,
and you could take that, being a frustrated artist, never make it. You could take that suggestion. You could expand on your exercise and go out with something like that.
Yeah, I think so. Absolutely. Because, you know, there's putting the word in your head and jumping out there and letting that inform your choices. That's different than when we're in a process, taking the fruit of that labor and then re-improvising it and analyzing it. And, you know, by the time you see the show, he's had a chance to turn that into written dialogue scene.
Right.
So it's, you know, the guy really pops and he really shines through. But as we both know, TJ, I bet you any money, it wasn't far off the mark the first time he improvised that scene.
Right. It's probably the third time, and it was in the show.
Yeah. Well, that show also had the scene Leaves in it, which is that extended blackout that he and Keegan Michael Key did, where they're raking leaves and talking about the fall. And he plays this very Bostonian kind of East Coast guy. From what I've always heard, that scene was like one and done. Like it was almost scripted exactly. They practically transcribed it from how they improvised it the first time. Those are few and far between. Those are a gem.
You get this job at Second City and a pandemic hit. All right.
Yes, Jimmy. And, are you saying that I caused the pandemic?
No, cause... I'm not saying that.
I will say that in my interview for the job, I told them that I wanted to expand our virtual learning opportunities.
Well, I'm
and then the pandemic hit.
About how you saw that before the pandemic comes.
How I saw the virtual learning thing?
Yeah, how I sat there before a pandemic and said, I want to expand our virtual
because I want to get this to everybody I can get it to. So I didn't know that the pandemic was coming. What I knew was that the spaces are finite, especially coming from LA. If you've ever been in the LA space, it's a hallway with like five classrooms. So it's finite. Like the spaces are finite in these three theaters, but improv is not. So I didn't really know how I wanted to do it. Cause honestly, that week in March that we all had to get together, our first conversation was like, can we do this? Does anybody want to do this? Would anybody want to improvise on Zoom? Like, will our students want to take these classes virtually? And I think for a lot of people that answer is no. Like, I know a lot of great improvisers who are like, yeah, no thanks, I'll be back when the Zoom thing's done. And I totally respect that. I get that. And there's a lot of students like that too. They want the real life experience. They want to be there. I 100% get that. But I think there were also a lot of students who wanted some joy in their lives, man. You know, like while this thing's going on, they're working from home or they're not even working. They wanted to stay with their ensemble and stay with their people. And even if it's an imperfect thing to do once a week on crappy Zoom, sorry Zoom, we love you, it's still connection. And I think that's why they wanted it. Also, all credit to our faculties. I mean, the faculties of all three theaters, I'm jumping ahead a little bit here, but they all got together and they worked their butts off and still are to deliver the great experience that they can deliver in person as teachers to these students, you know. And our teachers are that experience is our product. You know, one of the teachers said at one point, like, we don't in the training center, we don't sell a product, we sell an experience, and the teachers deliver that experience. And so they, you know, they're the ones in the classroom who dictate everything. They set the mood. If they walk in a bad mood, it's going to be a crappy class for the whole class, you know? And so for them to get on Zoom and be like, come on guys, this is going to be great. This is how we're going to do this. I think I've heard about this breakout room thing. Let's see if we can figure out how to work it. You know, they really were kind of reinventing a lot of the form. You know, they were adjusting exercises, what can work, what can't. They were sharing resources with each other, what warm-ups work on Zoom. It was amazing to watch. As awful as it's been, and as, you know, as crap a year as this has been for all of us, that is the shining part that I always point to and talk to people about, because we all got to witness something that all of us in improv never got to witness, which is a whole new way of doing this. You know, we inherited it decades into Second City and IO and improv being in existence when we came up, right? But here's this opportunity to do something in a way that's never been done before with improv and sketch. That's really kind of cool, even if it's a, you know, making best of a bad situation environment.
Second City has gone through a lot of transitions. Mm-hmm. All right. We've got new ownership.
Yep.
We've got everything's virtual right now.
Yeah.
Certainly, I think you inherited, the morale was kind of low when mm-hmm. you came in
yep.
with the teachers.
Absolutely.
We had the systemic racism issue.
Yep. Yep.
There was a letter to Second City, to Andrew. Andrew steps down. What is your vision of the training center now? It's almost like starting from scratch in a way, isn't it?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, you know, I want to build that vision together with the faculty. You know, one of the things, ironically, that did draw me most to the job was the collaboration that the AD in Chicago got to do, because there was, you know, the faculty is so immense there and the programs are so immense there. So there was like program heads and all of these people who kind of, you know, it's not just in LA, I was associate artistic director. I was kind of just running the training center kind of all myself. And in Chicago, there's sort of a lot of people to do that with. And then of course the pandemic hits. And so there's three rounds of layoffs, among them, the program heads. So that's the hardest part, you know, that's the hardest part training center wise for me, is like where the numbers are and where I want them to be. But, you know, it is my dream. It is my hope that collaboration will be able to return, because there are so many people at the training center in Chicago who have dedicated their lives, and in Los Angeles and Toronto too, but in Chicago especially, I feel like, you know, there's a joke that somebody said one time about improvising in LA, and I think it's funny because I think it's true of most people, myself included, when I moved out there. When you play a set with somebody in Chicago, you're playing with people who hope they get to do this for the rest of their lives. And when you play a set with somebody in LA, you're playing with somebody who hopes they never have to do it again, because nobody moves to LA to be an improviser. If you wanted to be an improviser for your entire career and your entire life, you'd stay in a less expensive market where there's more, you know, ready work. And so the thing about Chicago is there are teachers in Chicago, there are fantastic teachers in Los Angeles and Toronto, but a lot of those folks, very understandably so, have moved to those markets to take the next step in their own personal career. And in Chicago, a lot of people are like, like I said earlier, you turn around and you realize this is your life's work that you've built. And they're people that I've respected and looked up to since I was coming up that teach there. And these are the people that I'm excited to work with. And so my dream, my passion is to shape and build the training center and the future together. And honestly, that's what's kept me going throughout this year, is like my little world is the training center. And I really want, and it's been extremely difficult because a lot of the teachers that I work with, I've never met in person. I've been assigning them classes for a year now, and I've never even met any of them. So I understand that it's incredibly frustrating for them too. Like, you know, it's easy for me to say, oh, the camaraderie and the, you know, I want to work with everybody and the, you know, the ensemble of it all. And there hasn't been able to be that for this past year, but I hold on to that. I can't wait for that. I want us all in the building together again. I want us all building things together again. I want to help them in the same way that I said I wanted to help the actors when I became producer in Detroit, with bridges between different disciplines. If you've always taught improv, but you want to teach writing, you know, I think these are incredible artists who are so gifted, and to be able to help people learn this form, you know, I want to help them blossom in their careers. I really, really do. And together, with the teachers, with the faculty, then I want us all to help the students accomplish their dreams, because that's the goal. That's who we're there for, is the students, and for them to be able to, you know, for that next person coming up through the training center who's dreaming of being on the main stage, to be able to help usher them along that path. It's giving back, you know. I got to do that. I got to do the greatest job in the world, you know, and be on that stage and speak my piece and have that fun. And I really want to help more students find the path, you know, light the path to that for them.
And how important is building up the reputation of the training center again?
It's everything. And it's, you know, and I think that the, you know, the teachers know how to do that. You know, they need to be allowed to do that, you know, and encouraged and helped to do that. But they are the experts. And I say that to every one of them when I talk to them, like, they're the experts. I'm not there to dictate their lesson plans to them. I'm there to design curriculum, certainly, and design syllabi, but I'm not there to dictate, you know, what warmups they use each night. Like, they, I want them to bring their years of experience to the students. And I want the students to be able to learn from, you know, all sorts of different types of people with different experience levels. And I want the students to be able to learn from people who have shared backgrounds and shared experiences with them, because that's so important, because this work is very personal. So I want students of color to be able to work with teachers of color. I want, you know, I want students, you know, I want different gender identities, different, you know, everything. I want our students to be able to look to their teachers as mentors who have shared experiences, who can help them, you know, get to where they need to be. And then together, I want us to kind of conquer the world, you know. No, I mean, but jokingly, but seriously, I feel like this gift that's been given to us with virtual improv is never going to go away. Because one of the most exciting things to me now is, now we have auditions for our advanced conservatory. We just had them last week. And now the first thing we ask everybody is, where are you calling from? Which is something we never asked in an audition, because we were always in the room together in Chicago. But now it's like, hey, where are you calling from? And Jimmy, the answers, I mean, you know, we'll have a group of 12 people and maybe two of them are in Chicago, and they're in Paris, and they're in South Africa, and they're in Australia. It's midnight here. It's 9 a.m. the next day here. We have, you know, students taking classes from literally all over the world. And that happened inadvertently. It was the thing that I said was my goal. And then it was gifted to me in the midst of this horrific thing of a year. And that's what I've hung on to, because that's my goal. I want to help expand the training center to be able to reach people all over the world. And if we can return to our in-person learning and create more opportunity for virtual learning, then that's more work for everybody. And, you know, and it's not lost on me that each term, this is kind of the other thing I've hung on to throughout a really bad year. Every 7-8 weeks, I'm able to give work to improvisers. And that's saying something this year. Like, there's a lot of artists not working right now. I believe the number was 32 million at one point. So there's been a lot of bad that has happened this year. But if I can give someone one improv class, one writing class, that's helping them kind of get through this time, that's an honor to be able to do that.
So as we wrap this interview up, when are we going to see live classes, and what are they going to look like?
Live classes are actually starting pretty soon, a few of them in the next term in May, but just a few. They're going
for kids.
Adults. Yes. But it's very few. And they're going to look the same way that the camp, we did camps last summer, a couple of camps, and they're going to look the same way that those camps look. The one great thing right now is they've got the run of that entire building, because there's no shows going on, unfortunately. So, you know, that you'll cap a class that used to be capped at 12 or 14 at 8 students, and you space them out in a room the size of, you know, the main stage or up
or
18. Yeah, just one huge open learning center.
And you're doing it by walkie-talkie?
Yep, that's right. But they truly are. I mean, we have this picture of a room that's taped out, spaced out, you know. God love, again, Abby Wagner, she went in there last summer when we did the camps, and literally spaced out 6 feet apart in these massive rooms for, you know, 6 students, 8 students. And we made them for the kids for last summer, we made them learning circles. We taped these circles on the ground so that they had their little area where they had like their lunch and their mask. But it was like one small group of a pod of students with their one teacher. And then that's it. Like, they are the only people, you know, and everything's in place, temperature checks, all of the things, masks, obviously, you know. And we're doing classes like, you know, writing classes. I believe people think, you know, it's my opinion that we can distance pretty safely and still get the the desired effect, you know. But it's very, very hard to make a call on that stuff, because obviously safety comes first, and it's the thing that we're the most concerned about. And it wasn't lost on anybody that while we started making these plans to hopefully return next term, the numbers were going up again, you know. They look like they're starting to go back down now. And so it's always in everyone's mind of like one person has a temperature or anything like that, and the whole thing is just taken back off, and it goes back to virtual immediately. So all of the safety things are put in place, but the students can't wait. I mean, they really can't wait to be back. They're very, very excited to be back in person, as you know, as I'm sure we understand. And I think we're in for a lot of waves with this thing. You know, I was just talking to a girl in Australia last week, and she was talking about how they're doing great down there. They're like having concerts and stuff. And I was telling her how jealous we all are. And she said, yeah, but with like the small arts organizations, there was a group, nonprofit group, that plans this sketch fest near Brisbane. And they did this sketch festival, and they had the whole thing planned, ready to go. And then there was a little flare up in a small town nearby, and the whole thing got canceled. And those are the people that I'm really worried about. Like I'm so worried about these small arts organizations that have gone through this last year, and some have lost their spaces, their physical spaces. And then, you know, you try to come back and you organize this thing, and then if there's one little flare up, the whole thing can get shut down. And I wonder how many stops and starts we're going to have coming back from this thing. I don't think there's ever going to be a day where we feel like it's over for a long time.
You bring up a good point in terms of Chicago, because mm-hmm. we've lost.
We really have.
I.O.
Yeah.
We've lost other small improv and sketch theaters in this town. How do you see Chicago's place? Are we going to retain the mecca of improv?
I think so. I mean, I also hope that, you know, I think we will, because I think that, you know, I think there's enough. It's about the people, right? It's about the artists, and there are enough of them here, and there's enough passion here to bring it back. But I'm also really excited about people everywhere who, you know, don't you think amazing art is going to come out of this time?
Yes.
So, I mean, I think it's going to happen all over the country. I don't think we are, you know, I don't think we're exclusive in that. But yeah, I do. I mean, personally, again, that's another reason. That's another thing that keeps me going and keeps me excited and motivated at Second City, is I feel like everybody knows how tough it was for us to make it through this year. And we did. And I feel like we have a responsibility to help other people. And if there's one person in sort of the new rebuilding team that I'm really excited for everybody to get to know, it's John Carr, our new executive producer. He's the real deal. He used to run Dad's Garage down in Atlanta. He's an amazing guy, and I love working with him. And we talk all the time about that responsibility, the outreach, the helping of the community. You know, I don't know what it'll look like yet, and I don't know what everybody really needs yet, but I know that, you know, it's whether it's a place to play, whether it's space, whether it's a, you know, a coalition of theaters so that people can resource share and talk to each other. I want to help in any way we can, because it breaks my heart. It's, you know, like 32 million people or something.
And what artists, would you tell people that are in smaller communities that don't have the resources and the history of Chicago? What would you tell them to keep, you know?
I would say, once upon a time, there was a little purple building in Hamtramck, Michigan, called the Planet Ants. And if you can do it there, you can do it anywhere. That place is literally a house. And, you know, I feel like just do it. Just get together and play. And now the thing that I'm going to sound 100 years old. The thing that these kids have that we didn't have, Jimmy, but truly is the difference in mediums. You know, you couldn't make a web series when we started out. There was, you know, Whose Line was barely on TV. Like nobody even knew what improv was, but now you can create and get it out to the world. You know, do your TikToks, kids, do your TikToks and your YouTubes. But truly get together and make art.
We got to wrap this up, and we ask the same question. We end each episode with, what one piece of advice would you give to an improviser starting out today?
Be yourself and set your goals. If you want to be a professional performer, define what success means to you. I've had this conversation with a million students, because if you don't know what your definition of success is, then you're never going to know when you get there. And I'm here to tell you that there are people making multi-million dollar movies right now, and all they're thinking about is where their next job's going to come from. And that's what this work does to people, because you get so much rejection, you hear so much no, that when you finally get a yes, it's like, okay, yeah, I got that. But am I going to get the next thing? But look what that person's got. Look what's on their plate. And social media has only exacerbated that. So you've got to define success for yourself, or else when and if you do get famous or whatever it is, you're going to be lost inside it, because you won't know when to stop and appreciate it.
What is your definition of success for you?
Wow. This is going to sound so cheesy. I kind of think I'm living it. No, but I do. I mean, you know,
you have a lot of famous friends too.
Okay? Sure. So, I do have a lot of famous friends.
It's hard not to compare.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Well, I think I have a couple things going for me. As I told you way back when I was, 21, I can prove that I don't care that I'm famous. Okay. Way back when I was 21, I didn't care if I did TV or film. It was never my draw. Mm-hmm. When I first started working in the little bits of TV stuff that you get or whatever it is, or little bits of background work in film or whatever, I hated sitting around for 6 hours to work for 2 minutes. Like, I love a connection with a live audience. I really do. And do I regret that never was like a Broadway thing? Nope. Because again, this improv sketch thing found me, and it gave me my best friends, and it allowed me, when I wanted to be an actor on Broadway, I never dreamed that I'd be able to create my own stuff, that I'd be able to write Garage, that I'd be able to write all the main stage shows that I did. So to create my own work and to now be a person who can write, teach, direct, produce, do all of the things and make money doing all of the things, I'm so much more grateful for that, And so for me, success is, it sounds so cheesy, but I'm in it for the experiences now. I'm old enough at this point that it's like, I took this job because I thought, that's the next thing that I'd like to get. It was the next challenge to kind of go and do, and a bigger stage, if you will, to help more people. And I'm super into kind of giving back. I feel like I've had a lot of success in the improv community, because to me, success isn't, am I a movie star like my other improv friends, or, or on TV or whatever. Success to me was like, I did all the things that I've set out to do, and I continue to get to do all the things that I set out to do. So, I really like creating opportunities for other people.
Nancy Hayden,
Jimmy,
I can't think of a better way to end.
I mean, you set me up for that one. You made me look good, my friend.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. That's a good thing. That's a super good thing.
I love you. Thank you so much.
I love you. This was a blast. Oh my gosh. Thank you for having me. This is another life goal achieved, Jimmy.
And there you have it. Another great episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. And I want to thank my guest from the Second City Training Center in Chicago, Nancy Hayden. I'd also like to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick, so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you would not be hearing my voice right now. For more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes and workshops and intensives called The Art of Slow Comedy, go to my website at jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. Follow us on Twitter at improv_nerd. Like us on our Improv Nerd Facebook page, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Pick up my books on Amazon, and support our Patreon for, we do a thing teaching the art of slow comedy. They're like little mini master classes if you want, as a teacher or as a performer. I think it would really help. So check that out. And if you like what we do, find some place that you can leave a review and tell us how much you like what we do here. Because I'm such a fragile person. That's it. Thank you for listening. Until next time, remember, walk, don't run.